Your Honor, at this time, defendant Danny Banks moves for a directed verdict. As the court knows, Mr. Banks is charged with capital murder. Because this is a capital murder case, the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution requires a greater degree of accuracy and fact-finding that would be true in a non-capital murder case. Despite this greater degree of accuracy, not one scintilla of evidence has been presented.
One of the attorneys for Daniel Villegas was arguing in court for a directed verdict, saying that the prosecution had presented no evidence at trial tying his client to the crime. And so the defense wanted the judge to issue a verdict right then, instead of sending the case to the jury. This sort of thing isn't uncommon for a defense to argue this after the prosecution has presented their case. But Daniel's attorney was insistent.
It's extraordinary that even the state itself has failed to call even one of its case detectives, even one of its law enforcement detectives, not a single one. There's not one piece of physical evidence that links any of the allegations to Mr. Villegas, not a single piece. In fact, all of their strongest witnesses have retracted all their statements, every single one. All the rest of the testimony can't even be considered evidence. It's based on secondhand data. It's based on corrupted memory. It's based on pure gossip. And this is a court of law, not a court of gossip.
His client, Daniel Villegas, sat quietly at the defense table, his hands folded underneath his chin as he looked on, waiting to hear what the judge would say. It's October 4th, 2018, but the crime occurred much earlier. 25 years earlier, in fact. Prosecutors allege that when Daniel was 16 years old, he had pulled his car up next to a small group of teenage boys walking down the street in Northeast El Paso and fired his gun at them, striking and killing two. It was day three of the trial and the prosecution had just rested their case. Now, the defense wanted the judge to agree that there wasn't enough evidence against their client. Generally speaking, granting a motion for a directed verdict isn't very common, and this case was no different. Judge Sam Medrano Jr. denied their motion. It would be up to the jury to decide. Was Daniel Villegas guilty?
He pretty much said if I didn't sign this, that he was going to charge me with capital murder, and that, and excuse my language, I was going to get fucked in prison. He says, those guys are going to have their way with you. So when someone tells you that you're going to prison and you're going to get raped, you start to visualize a lot of things.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 131. Nowadays, I think many of us would rather color our hair in the comfort of our own home. But if you're like me, you're likely wondering how you would find the right color and then how much does it cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. There used to be only two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon. But not anymore. Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And finding the perfect shade is easy. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that asks you questions about your hair, like what you want your end result to be and what your hair texture is, and then they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. We all love podcasts, right? Well, today I have a recommendation for you, one that you really should be listening to. It's the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's a podcast you should definitely check out if you're a fan of high-quality, fascinating podcasts hosted by interesting people. The show covers such a wide range of topics through weekly interviews with heavy-hitting guests. And there are a ton of episodes that I know you'll find interesting since you're a fan of Court Junkie. For example, I'd recommend checking out the episode with Danny Trejo, inmate number one, and also the one with Amanda Knox. There's an episode for everyone, though, no matter what you're into. The show covers stories like how a professional art forger somehow made millions of dollars while being chased by the feds and the mafia. Jordan's also done an episode all about birth control and how it can alter the partners we pick and how going on or off the pill can change elements of our personalities. I really enjoyed this show, and I think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And stay tuned to the end of this episode for a clip of Jordan's episode with Moby. April 9th, 1993 was a Friday. Good Friday, in fact.
There was a small house party on a street called Jamaica in northeast El Paso.
The party went into the early morning hours until shortly after midnight. But as it was coming to an end and partygoers were heading home, four teenage boys were left waiting on their ride. Jesse Hernandez, Armando Lazo, Bobby England, and Juan Medina. All were juniors at Andras High School. Their ride didn't show up, and so they eventually decided to just walk home.
And they decided we'll walk along Trans Mountain because there's a lot of traffic, and hopefully if we get into any trouble, if we get jumped or if we get attacked, people will see us. People will be able driving by and they'll be able to stop us.
As they walked east on Trans Mountain Road, a car drove by them, slowly, and then stopped. At first, the boys thought it was their ride, who had finally come to pick them up.
And so they walk up to the car, and then it drives away a little bit. Well, that's kind of weird. And they walk up to it again, and it drives away a little bit. And that happens two or three times. Obviously, they get upset and they yell at the car and it leaves. And they think that was weird.
They continued walking, and before long, they saw the car again. This time, the car stopped, parked, and turned its headlights off. All four boys walked towards the car.
Words were exchanged. They heard from the car, "¿Qué putos?" And then shots rang out. And everyone ran. The four of them ran.
When the gunshots rang out, Jesse and Juan ran down the street and hid behind a dumpster. Armando and Bobby were both struck with bullets. Bobby had been hit in the head and died shortly thereafter. Armando was shot in his abdomen and thigh and managed to run to a neighbor's house before collapsing on the front steps. Both died from their injuries. Armando was 17 and Bobby was 18. Daniel Villegas, though he had no known ties to any of the victims, was eventually charged with the murders. In October 2018, Assistant District Attorney James Montoya gave the opening statements on behalf of the state. He admitted that drive-by shootings like this are exceptionally hard to investigate.
They're hard. Because the person shows up, the shooting happens, and they drive away with the murder weapon. They don't leave fingerprints. They don't leave DNA. Sometimes there's no witnesses. You're going to see that what makes this case particularly difficult is that the two surviving eyewitnesses, Mr. Medina and Mr. Hernandez, they were not able to see inside the car. It had tinted windows. They couldn't see how many people it was, who was inside of it. You're going to hear that both of them gave conflicting descriptions about the car. They gave different colors, different makes and models. You're going to hear that the only physical evidence left at the scene were the shell casings that were fired out of the gun.
He said all the casings were .22 caliber. All were fired from the same gun. But that gun has never been recovered. The casings were run through a bullet and firearm database, but to this day, they have never matched to any other crime scene, meaning that gun has never been used in a crime that was then put in the database. So how do you solve a crime like this? He asked.
People talk. People talk in the streets. They talk in their homes. They talk in their schools. And this case is no different. People start chit-chat, start talking.
He said investigators listened to the chit-chat and followed the leads. That one person's voice was the loudest, the clearest, the most consistent. Daniels.
The reason why we are in this courtroom 25 years later, why you're sitting in this jury box, why he's sitting in that chair, is because of his own words. You're going to hear that he admitted to doing this shooting. He admitted to doing this capital murder again and again and again.
He said Daniel told his cousin David that he committed the shooting, the one that was all over the news, and that he told some girls at a local mall that he did too. Then, when he was in custody prior to trial, he told someone in the El Paso County Jail that he did it. And after he was released on bond, he told yet another friend of his that he did it. That is why we're here today, Montoya told the court.
I anticipate that throughout this trial, the defendant's going to say or the defendant's going to argue, well, I made it up, or I was just joking, or I just was trying to be a tough guy. In all of these instances, and you saw Mr. Spencer yesterday in the jury selection, why would someone falsely confess? Do you remember that? Because how do you explain telling these people, I did it, over and over and over and over again?
He has no one to blame but himself, Montoya said. His own words condemn him, and it's on the basis of his own words that we are going to ask you to convict him. Daniel's lead defense attorney was Joe Spencer, and as noted by KTSM Channel 9, he was one of the most experienced and well-known defense attorneys in El Paso. He gave the opening statements for the defense. Spencer described the night of April 9th, 1993. He described the four boys leaving the house party and starting to walk home.
So the easiest way for them to get to their home would be to go to Fairbanks and walk right down Fairbanks. But they didn't do that. And Jesse Hernandez will tell you they didn't do that, and he's going to tell you the route they took. And they decided, you know what? This is a real bad area here. There's some bad gangbangers there. In 1993, El Paso had a real gang problem, not only in Northeast El Paso, but especially in Northeast El Paso. And there were some really bad people living in that area that was their territory. They wouldn't even let some people drive down the street because it was their territory. The Flores Brothers. You're going to hear about them. You're going to hear they're the ones that actually committed the offense.
He said the Flores brothers, Rudy and Javier, were in a gang and that they had actually been involved in an argument with Armando Lazo in the past on more than one occasion, and that the brothers lived less than a quarter mile away from where the shooting occurred. 2 weeks prior to the murders, Rudy Flores threatened Armando and told him he was going to kill him while they were at a party. Then, just 1 week before the murders, both Flores brothers threatened Armando, this time at school. Spencer said this did not go unnoticed by investigators, and that the day after the shooting, officers went to pay Rudy Flores a visit. Rudy said he was home when the shooting occurred. Rudy then gave investigators a statement a couple days later, on April 14, 1993. He said he was with some friends and they were over at another friend's house, a friend who also lives on Jamaica Street, near where the party was. Rudy said he saw some boys when he drove by that night who kind of stared at him, but he told police he ignored them and drove right by. Spencer said that's the approximate location where the boys had that cat and mouse game with the car they thought was their ride. He said neighbors heard 6 gunshots at 12:18 a.m. They called 911 and then they heard frantic knocking at their door. It was Armando Lazo, who collapsed in the doorway when they opened it.
Well, we know at the time that it occurred simply because of the 911 call that came in. Rudy Flores places himself at the scene of the crime at 12:18, in his own words. Because he says in his statement, because see, Rudy Flores is street smart. So he's concerned that somebody might have seen my car drive by there. So how do I explain my car drove by there? So he says in his statement, oh, I went and dropped off Betty, and then I went down Trans Mountain Road. He tells him the route that the boy stood, and then I drove up Electric Street because I wanted to go straight to my house. And when I drove by there, there was no lights, no sirens, and I didn't see anything. So what time did you drive by there? And Rudy Flores' own words says between 12:15 and 12:20. That's his words to the police, to the detective. He puts himself at the scene, opportunity, at the time that the offense occurred.
Spencer said investigators were under a lot of pressure to solve the case, and that they accused other people of the crime, including the 2 surviving victims. As for what evidence they have against Daniel, he argued that there is no physical evidence, no forensic evidence, no scientific evidence, no eyewitness testimony, no fingerprints, and no DNA. He said as they were accusing other people, they eventually got around to Daniel, even though Daniel didn't know any of the victims or the Flores brothers. Spencer also cast doubt on anyone who said Daniel confessed to them.
They are desperate. They are desperate. Quantum leaps. No physical evidence. No forensic evidence. The police were under enormous investigation. Prosecutor tells you in opening statement, they follow the lead. They follow the evidence. Did they really?
Spencer said he is confident that at the end of the trial, the jury will find Daniel, who had no ties to the case, not guilty. Hector Hernandez was a patrol officer assigned to the crime scene unit back in April 1993. He arrived at the scene of the shooting at about 1:30 a.m. The body of Bobby England was still there, but Armando Lazo had been taken to the hospital. He said he only focused on the area where Bobby's body was found and that no one told him where Armando had been lying. On cross, Joe Spencer harped on this.
It would be important, would it not, for a crime scene technician and a detective with an IDNR to try to gather as much forensic evidence, biological evidence, and everything that they could preserve for later use. Fair?
Yes.
To determine who may or may not be the perpetrator, correct?
Yes.
Or even if you found yourself in trial 25 years later, after the fact, it helped you to refresh your memory on your testimony. Fair?
Yes.
Because as we know, with time, memories fade, correct?
Yes, sir.
Jesse Hernandez was 17 years old on April 9th, 1993. He said he, his cousin Hector, and 3 friends went to a small gathering on Jamaica Street that night. At some point, Hector, who had driven the group to the party, decided to leave with a girl. He said he would be back. But as the party was coming to an end and people started to go home, Hector had not returned. Jesse and his friends, Armando, Bobby, and Juan, were left inside waiting for their ride. When minutes turned into an hour, they decided to walk home. The plan was to walk to Armando's house, and from there, they would use a car to get the others home. They were walking east on Trans Mountain Road when they got to the intersection between Trans Mountain and Kellogg.
When we get to Kellogg, a car approaches us, and first instinct was, hey, my cousin's picked us up. But Mondo and Bobby, they saw the car first because they were in front of me. And when this car pulls up, they start yelling at the car. And then I say, and I look at the car and I say, that's not my cousin's car.
And so at first you think it is your cousin?
Yes. Okay. I mean, why else would anybody pull over and, I mean, and just stop right there on a busy street on Sharon's mom?
So at first you think it's your cousin?
Yes.
And you guys approach the car as if it is your cousin?
Yes.
And what happens when you approach this car thinking it's your cousin? Are you all saying anything to your cousin?
Well, Mondo and Bobby were pretty irate because for the fact that we had to walk, and they left us there for quite a considerable time. So they were angry and they were yelling at the cars like, "What the hell are you doing? What took you forever?" And I'm grabbing Mondo by the shoulder and I'm telling him, "That's not my cousin's car." And he says, "The hell it ain't. That is your cousin." I said, "That's not the car. Look at the car. That's not the car." So when he realized that wasn't my cousin's car, he said, "Oh man, that isn't."
The windows of the car were heavily tinted, making it impossible to see who was inside. Jesse thought there was going to be a confrontation, but instead, the car went forward a couple feet, stopped, reversed, and then took off. The boys continued walking. They crossed the street. Two of his friends decided to start wrestling, which annoyed him. He wanted to get home. He testified that out of the corner of his eye, he noticed a car turning onto Electric Street, going north. The car turned its lights off while still in motion.
I remember I just took a quick glance at the vehicle, and my thoughts were, "Oh my God, it's probably the same car that approached us," because it turned off its lights. But at the same time, it could have been anybody that just wanted to park there. So I didn't really. It kind of scared me, but it didn't. How can I say? I didn't think much of it until we started. Mondo put on his shirt. He put back on his shirt, and we started to walk. And that's when words were yelled out from the car.
And what were those words that were yelled out from the car?
I don't know if I can say them in the court, but it was a Spanish saying. They just said, "Qué putos." That's what they said. That's all it was. I remember was "Qué putos."
And that's clearly not friendly,
no.
Right? And at that point, do you recognize that it is the same car, or you still cannot tell?
The only thing I remember from that night, because it was dark, was I saw clearly was I can see the chrome rims and that white top.
Okay.
He said Bobby and Armando took 3 or 4 steps towards the car when the shots were fired.
When I hear the shots and I see... I mean, I'm looking at Mondo and Bobby and they're walking a couple of steps. And when I'm in this angle, I see like a glow. And I'm, you know, I can't say or it's just what I remember, a glowing light. And I hear a ping, like if it, one hit the fence, like a few flick up, but like a hard ping.
Okay.
And I just ran as fast as I could.
Okay.
After hiding behind a dumpster, he and Juan ran to a nearby store, but the door was locked. He kept shaking the door, thinking that the car was nearby and fearing that it would be coming for them. They waited there for about 15 to 20 minutes before heading back to the scene. By then, they could see red and blue lights from the police vehicles. Armando was strapped onto a stretcher, but they didn't see Bobby. They told the officers that one of their friends was missing, and the officers put him and Juan in the backs of separate squad cars. He then watched as the officers searched the field with flashlights for his missing friend. Jesse was then taken to the police station, where he gave them a statement about what happened. He said he talked as Detective Alfonso Marquez typed. On cross-examination, Jesse said he doesn't know Daniel Villegas. Attorney Joe Spencer asked if he knew the Flores brothers, and he said yes, although he wasn't aware of any confrontations Armando had with them. He was asked if the Flores brothers were known to terrorize that area, and he said yes. A couple days after Armando's funeral, Detective Marquez picked him up and took him back to the police station. The first time he had given his statement, he had been in a cubicle. Now he was in an interrogation room. He said Detective Marquez then accused him of having killed his friends.
Were you scared?
I was scared and confused at the same time.
Did you tell him that you didn't do it?
I said, how could you say that? I said, how could you say that, sir? And he says, your friend Juan seen you did it. You have every motive to do it. You have Bobby's ring. You have his beeper. For all we know, you even wanted his girlfriend, and you wanted him dead. And I just couldn't fathom that he would say that, or even Juan would say that. And he said, well, you know what? You're going to have to explain it to the judge because they're going to fry your ass. And he walked out, and I just put my head down, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And
what were you thinking?
I was already thinking, how did I do it? I was already imagining that I did it. But then I said, how did I get the gun? Where did I get the gun? And I just kind of like, I was not there in the moment anymore.
He was asked if he came close to confessing.
If he pushed a little longer, yeah. All I wanted to do was just leave that room and go home.
Did he cuss at you?
Yeah, he cursed at me. He gave me, when everything started, he gave me a notepad and he says, I need you to give me detail, word for word, exactly what had happened. And I wrote it on a legal notepad, a yellow legal notepad. And he grabs it and he starts reading it. And he tosses it at me. He says, let's cut the bullshit. You know it and I know it. You're lying. So why don't you just confess and say you did it? It's because your friend's saying you did it. And for my friend Juan to say that, I was like, why would he say that? What was his motive? What was the reason for him to say that? He has to be true.
You even thought it had to be true if Juan is saying it?
Yeah.
Did you shoot your friends, Jesse?
No, sir. No.
You were there when your friends were killed and you were shot at.
Yes, sir.
He was asked if it still bothers him 25 years later, and he said yes. Every time he talks about what happened, he feels like he's a child in that room again, like he's frozen in that time. On redirect, Assistant District Attorney Denise Butterworth asked Jesse if he knows who a man named John Membella is. Jesse said yes, he's the owner of a local business, Membella Construction in El Paso. He said that at some point, John Membella came over to his apartment with a private detective that Membella had hired on behalf of Daniel Villegas. They told him they wanted to talk to him about this case. He testified that he met with John Membella about 5 or 6 times. Butterworth then asked about whether Membella gave him tickets to the Sun Bowl and a boxing match. He said yes.
Mr. Hernandez, you gave a statement to the El Paso Police Department right after this occurred in April of 1993, correct?
Yes.
Then you had an opportunity to make additional statements regarding this incident and being questioned on this incident in 1994.
Yes.
You never mentioned this new part about the detective following up days later and taking you into a room and making the threats that you've testified to today. Did you in 1994?
Can you ask the question again?
Did you ever in 1994 ever mention this part about Detective Marcus following up a few days later, locking you in a room and making the threats?
I mentioned it to my mother.
In 1994.
I mentioned it to my mother.
In 1994, when you were making statements regarding this issue and questioned on this issue, not by your mother, sir, in a prior hearing, did you mention that in 1994?
I was never asked. No.
But you never mentioned it?
No.
You never said it?
No.
In 1995, when you also had an opportunity to make statements regarding this issue and be questioned regarding this issue, did you ever mention this new part about Detective Marcus threatening you days later after that initial 1993 statement?
No.
Joe Spencer was heated during recross.
Were you ever asked in 93 or 94 about the second time that Detective Marcus picked you up?
No, sir.
But when you were asked about it in 2011, you talked about it, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
And when I asked you about it for the first time, that's when you told them about the threats. And everything you told this jury, you told them in 2011, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
And they know that, don't they?
Yes, sir.
They're somehow trying to suggest to you that, did John Novella bribe you?
No, sir.
Would you take money to deny justice for your friends?
No, sir.
Is money more important than justice for your friends?
Justice is what I want.
Are you lying to this jury about what you saw?
No, sir. No.
Juan Medina was the second survivor from the night of the shooting. He took the stand and told the court that he was currently incarcerated. He recounted the same sequence of events from that night as Jesse. Then the prosecutors focused on possible gang ties. Juan said he used to live in the Eisenhower Projects and that there was a gang there called Eisenhower Crazy Hood, or ECH. He said he hung out with them but wasn't in the gang himself, although he used to get labeled that way. He testified that he knew of Rudy Flores and his brother Javier, but didn't know them. He said he believed Armando had problems with Javier. When asked if he had ever stated differently, he said he can't remember if he did or not. Assistant District Attorney Denise Butterworth showed him his earlier statement he gave to police, where he had said no, none of them had any problems with Rudy or Javier. He agreed he said that. He was asked if he knew John Membella, and he said yes, that he has met with him before. Membella asked him if he could get in touch with Armando's mom, but he was unable to. He was asked if he was ever employed by John Membella, and he said he was having some financial problems and that Membella gave him some side jobs. He had also loaned him some money at some point. On cross, Juan said Detective Marquez accused him of being the killer, too.
You're a victim in this case, correct?
Correct.
And at some point when you spoke with one of the detectives, you were also accused of being part of the killers for your friends, weren't you?
Yes.
I mean, they bullied you and basically told you that you had been, you and your friends, you and Jesse, were the ones that killed Armando and Robert, didn't they?
Yes.
Juan said when John Membella contacted him, he wanted to know what happened and what he saw.
He asked you what happened, correct?
Correct.
He probably asked you a lot more questions about what was that happened that evening than the detectives asked you. Fair?
Fair.
Gave you information to see what you knew because he felt Daniel was innocent, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So he was doing an investigation to see what you could find out that the police didn't find out. Is that fair?
Yes, fair.
Daniel's cousin, David Ronhell, testified that he and Daniel grew up together. Their mothers are sisters. In April 1993, he was 17 and a junior in high school, a year older than Daniel. On April 21st, 1993, he said he gave a statement to the El Paso police about the shooting.
In this particular statement, or back in April of 1993, did you tell the El Paso Police Department that the defendant told you that he committed the shooting?
Yes.
Okay.
He said he had called Daniel 4 days after the shooting, on April 14th, 1993. He was calling to see what Daniel was doing over the weekend.
So you call him, and what does he tell you regarding this incident?
What does he tell me regarding the incident?
Yes, sir.
From what I remember, what he told me was when we initially were speaking, We were just more of shooting the breeze. And then I think the conversation came up just because it was pretty popular in El Paso during that time. Usually when there was any kind of activity, we would talk about things because sometimes we knew people that may have been hurt. And so this particular conversation, I don't remember how exactly it came up, but then we started discussing it.
Okay. And what did he tell you?
He told me, guess who did it? And okay. I don't know. And then he said, well, guess. And I'm like, I have no idea. And so we kind of went back and forth a few times. And then he says, I did. And so during this conversation, I could hear Marcos Gonzalez laughing in the background while he was discussing this.
Okay. So he says, I did it. And do you ask him or follow up why?
I did.
Okay. And what does he say next?
I think he's, my memory serves correct. You recognize a couple of kids from Boomerangs.
From Boomerangs.
Correct.
What is Boomerangs?
Boomerangs back then was a movie theater, like a teenage hangout in the Northeast.
Okay. So he tells you he recognized some of them from Boomerangs.
Correct.
Does he tell you what they're doing?
That I don't remember.
Okay. Do you remember saying that they were throwing ECH?
Vaguely, yes. Okay. That sounds familiar.
He tells you they were throwing ECH. What and it looks like here you say ECH are the Eisenhower crazy hoods.
Okay.
Is that correct?
That sounds about right. Correct.
Okay.
According to the statement David gave to Detective Marquez on April 21st, 1993, Daniel told him the other boys were throwing up ECH gang signs, that he confronted them and then shot them.
Does he tell you that when he did the shooting, he meant to shoot Mondo?
Yes.
But missed and hit the guy next to him. So then what does he tell you he does at that point?
He shot again.
Okay. And when he shot again, what happened? Does he hit Mondo that time?
He said that he saw Mondo go down.
All right. And after Mondo goes down, what does the defendant tell you happens next?
From my memory, I remember he said that he didn't go down, and so he chased him and blasted him with a shotgun afterward.
According to the statement, Daniel said he was with one of their friends named Marcos Gonzalez and some other homeboys from VNE, which was a gang back then. Armando recognized him, and he couldn't just leave him as a witness. He said he chased him to a house and shot him again. In David's statement, it stated that Daniel did not tell him what kind of gun was used. This statement was typed. David testified that Detective Marquez was at his computer typing it as he spoke. David also gave police a handwritten statement that was more of a summary. It said Daniel said he shot two guys from ECH, that he passed by them and recognized one of them. They threw up gang signs and he shot one and saw the other run away. Daniel said he was too drugged up to think about it. In the handwritten statement, there was nothing about what kind of gun Daniel said he had used. David testified that he had told Detective Marquez that Daniel had told him it was a shotgun, but that Detective Marquez said to omit that part. Later that day, after David spoke with detectives, Daniel was arrested.
Back in 1993, how did his family react? Your aunt, it's your mom's sister. How did they react when they found out that you had given this information to the police?
I wasn't there when that was found out, okay. But we were still together afterwards. So again, I couldn't tell you.
Okay. You were not treated any differently by his family or by him when they found out that it was your information that led to his arrest?
No, we would still hang out together afterward. Okay.
I want to make sure, because I find this incredulous, I want to make sure that you're telling this jury that there was no reaction by his family, by his mother, your aunt, when they found out that he was arrested based on the information that you gave to the El Paso Police Department.
There may have been a reaction, but I wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you what the reaction was.
I'm not asking you the day he was arrested. I'm telling you in general that time frame. How did they react to knowing this, finding out about this?
Well, again, like I'm telling you, we were still together afterward.
So they loved you and hugged you and embraced you and thanked you.
I'm going to object. Argumentative.
Stay.
You're going to tell this jury there was no reaction.
I couldn't say that if there was no reaction, but again, I'm telling you, our family's pretty tight, so we were still with each other after the fact.
What was their reaction when they found out that you gave this information to the police department?
I wasn't there. I don't know.
I'm not saying that day. In the time that progressed...
Is that an answer and argumentative?
Yes, an answer to suspect.
David then told the jury that many things in his statement were not correct, that Detective Marquez hadn't typed what he had said exactly.
So these two statements, right, I'm looking at them, and I do remember the reason why this one versus this one, my own handwritten statement, there's a lot less information versus this one, is because Marquez started typing his own words into some of these. And you're asking me, is this true? And I'm like, yes, this was said, but like I told Marquez, I knew it to be false. That's what I kept telling Marquez the entire time. And so in regards to the shotgun, when I mentioned the shotgun several times to Marquez, Marquez didn't like that answer, so he kept yelling at me saying, no, that's not correct. So I didn't know what he needed and what he wanted for me to say.
Okay. So after your cousin is arrested in April of 1993, when did you go back to the police department or the DA's office and say, I need to explain to you that this isn't true, or however it is that you said happened?
I stated.
When did you tell, listen to my question. When did you go back to the police department? Your cousin has been arrested for capital murder. When did you go back to the police department to tell anyone about what happened to you on April 21st of 1993?
I didn't go back to the police department.
You never went to the police with this information?
Not that I'm aware of, no, ma'am.
But you're going to be, do you know what you did? Did you go back to the police department to tell them?
Jason Compound.
I'm sorry, rephrase that.
Did you go back to the police department after your cousin gets arrested for capital murder to clear this up, to tell somebody what happened?
I don't believe so. And the reason being was because of the way that the detectives handled me the first time. I was actually afraid to go back.
David said he never went to the DA's office either. Butterworth pointed out that the first time the prosecution had heard any of this was in 1994, after he had spoken with Daniel's attorney. At that time, he was also living with Daniel. Butterworth held up the typed statement that Detective Marquez had typed up. Is this what your cousin told you? David said one thing that was incorrect in the statement was that Daniel had just told him it was him and Marcos, not anything about other homeboys from VNE. On cross, David said that on the day he gave the statement to police, detectives had called his mom and told her that there was a harassment phone charge against him, which was true. His mom called him and said the detectives told her that if he just goes in and signs a few documents, they'll release him. They made it seem like a matter of normality. They picked him up and took him to the substation. He at first thought it was still for the phone harassment charge, but then they took him to another substation. He started getting nervous and asked the detective driving him if he was in trouble. He said the detective responded, "Oh yeah, you're in trouble." He said the car ride seemed incredibly long to him. His mind was racing and he was wondering what was going on. When they arrived at the other substation, Detective Marquez told him that he knows someone who said that he was guilty of capital murder. David said he didn't know what they were talking about, and he said, "We know you did it. We know you killed those boys." David said he asked, "Are you talking about the story my cousin told me?" Detective Marquez said yes, and then told him to tell them about it. He wrote down what Daniel had told him, and they crumpled it up and threw it away, telling him that wasn't correct. Daniel's attorney, Joe Spencer, asked David about that conversation with Daniel, which took place about a week after the shooting. There had been a lot of publicity about what happened. It was all over the newspapers and on the news. David had called Daniel, and after Daniel told him he did it, David said he didn't take him seriously.
Initially, when he told you, did you take him seriously?
No. Well, this is the thing, is that from the time Daniel and I have been kids, Daniel was always the kid that exaggerated about everything. He was, that's just the reputation he had. Like, when we were talking to girls, he was Italian, or he had a lowrider that was always in the shop. He was a 16-year-old kid, barely even owned a bike. But when I would look at him as he was discussing this, he would like, you know, with his big grin on his face. So when Daniel told me these things, you know, because he made up a lot of stuff, you don't take him seriously.
David said everyone was laughing about it, and that neither Daniel nor their friend Marcos even owned a car at that point. David said he told Detective Marquez that it was just a joke.
That joke has turned into Daniel's nightmare. You're aware of that?
Yes.
David then told the court that Detective Marquez coerced and threatened him.
He pretty much said if I didn't sign this, that he was going to charge me with capital murder. And excuse my language, I was going to get fucked in prison. At the time, I was 17 years old, probably weighed about 115, 120 pounds. He says, those guys are going to have their way with you. So when someone tells you that you're going to prison and you're going to get raped, you start to visualize a lot of things.
David said he wrote down his statement originally, but that Detective Marquez crumpled it up and threw it away. He didn't like the fact that, according to David, Daniel had said he used a shotgun. The victims had been shot with a .22 caliber gun. David maintained that everything in his statement had been put out in the media prior. He told the court that he's frustrated that he is still dealing with this now as a 42-year-old man. After David's testimony, the prosecution called a man named Fernando Lujan to the stand. Fernando sat down on the witness stand, but immediately asked for an attorney prior to testifying. The judge called a recess and an attorney was brought in. Outside the presence of the jury, the prosecutor said she was planning on asking him if he hung out with Daniel on the night of the shootings, and if he saw Daniel with a .22 caliber handgun. Fernando said he wanted to invoke his Fifth Amendment right to not testify. The prosecutor was not happy.
At this time, Your Honor, I would like to exercise my Fifth Amendment right.
For what crime? What am I accusing him of in these questions? This is where I'm confused, Judge. If we allow all witnesses to do this that don't want to cooperate in this case, which of course not, hardly any of these witnesses want to come in and cooperate and get involved in this case, for what crime?
Maybe giving a false statement to law enforcement. I don't know.
Of parties.
Mr. Lujan, you are excused from any subpoena that you are currently under.
The prosecutor let her paper fall to the floor in apparent exasperation. On the night of April 9th, 1993, El Paso police officer Jose Reveles responded to the scene of an apparent second shooting around 3 a.m. A caller had said they heard several gunshots being fired Right where Daniel Villegas lived. Officer Reveles said that when he arrived, he saw three individuals standing in the street, Daniel Villegas, Marcos Gonzalez, and Rodney Williams. He testified that he asked them about shots fired in the area and asked if they had heard anything. He said they were real vague with their answers and about what they were doing. He said two of them were under 17 and were subject to curfew. When he realized he wasn't getting any information from them, he asked Daniel and Marcos to go inside Daniel's house, and he took Rodney home. He testified that this was about 3 miles away from the earlier shooting. On cross, however, Officer Reveles said that the original caller had said that he saw a yellow Thunderbird leaving the area. Angelica Hernandez was 15 years old in 1993. One night in April 1993, she and her friend were outside Boomerang's theater when a group of about three boys called her and her friend over. They looked to be around the same age. They started talking to them, asking their names and what they were doing at the mall. She said she told them they were going to the movies. They then started talking about a drive-by shooting. She hadn't heard about it. They told her that they had shot two guys. She said she remembered one guy doing most of the talking. They told her they were from the VNE gang. She said she remembered being scared after this conversation, and that she told them that they had to go, and they walked away. She was asked if she has seen the guy who was talking to her since. She said yes on the news. She had told her mom and aunt about it, but after she saw that an arrest had been made, she decided not to go to the police. She said the person who was arrested was the same guy who had been talking. On cross, Angelica said she first sent an email to the DA's office in 2012. She wrote that she wanted to tell them something about the Daniel Villegas case. Daniel's other defense attorney asked her what movie she and her friend were going to see that night. She didn't remember. What was she wearing? She didn't remember. What was her friend wearing? She didn't remember. What were the guys wearing? She didn't remember. In her statement, she had said the guy who had been talking said he had a daughter. She said she doesn't recall that now.
Okay, so what you're saying is that you're unsure if what you remember is mm-hmm. your own memory mm-hmm. or what you read about.
Yes.
Okay. And so some of the things that you previously said about whether or not he told you had a baby, you're saying right now that maybe that's not what you remember. Maybe it's something that you read somewhere else. Is that right?
Just that part.
Just that part.
Yes.
But everything else you remember clearly. Is that right?
Yes.
25 years later.
Yes.
A cashier from a Chevron gas station was then called to the stand. But when asked about a statement she gave to investigators back in 1995, she said she remembers giving a statement, but doesn't remember what was in it. The prosecution tried to admit that statement, but the judge decided not to allow it after the defense objected. On cross, she said she didn't know the individual whom the statement was about, didn't recognize him, and that this was the first time in over 25 years that she has been asked about it. On redirect, the prosecution tried asking her more questions about it, but to no avail. She did not recall, and so the judge again denied to admit her statement into evidence. The prosecution's last witness was Oscar Gomez, who testified that he has known Daniel since middle school. After he was arrested and let out on bond, Daniel called and asked him if he wanted to hang out. He said this was the last time he would see him because he was going to prison. He went to Daniel's house and they smoked cigarettes. He testified that he remembers asking Daniel if he did it, but said he doesn't remember what Daniel's response was. It was a long time ago, he said. When asked if he ever said anything different, he described being picked up by police in 2014 for traffic warrants.
First, they told me that I was arrested because of my traffic warrants, that they were looking for me. And then when I got to the substation in Central, they had told me, well, you know something, you know what this is about? And I told them that I didn't. And then, well, this is about Danny Villegas' case, that we know that you know something. Okay.
And you ended up telling them what?
About me and Danny had a conversation about it.
And what else did you tell
him? That he had said that he did it. Okay.
The prosecutor showed a statement he gave in a recorded video interview with Detective Sanchez in 2014. He said he asked Daniel if Daniel did the shootings and that Daniel grinned and said, yeah, he did. Oscar agreed that's what he told the detective. That's what the detective wanted to hear, he said.
So you're saying that he made you say that?
Yes.
And
I tried to tell him that I didn't remember it.
Okay.
He wasn't taking it.
Sure.
He said he met with defense attorneys a couple days after the interview. When asked if he ever met with John Membella, he said no. On cross, Oscar said that prior to that videotape statement, He had been talking to Detective Sanchez for about 2 hours. He said Detective Sanchez told him that he wanted him to say that Daniel had admitted to the shooting, but he said no, he didn't remember.
And he told you, no, I'm going to make you remember. Is that what he told you?
Yes.
And he told you that if you didn't say what he wanted you to say, that he was going to put you in jail.
Yes.
And that's what he told you, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
And there were several times that you attempted to tell him, look, he didn't tell me that. He didn't make any admissions. And Detective Sanchez told you, I don't want to hear that.
Yes, sir.
Right. And in fact, he told you, look, I'll let you go. If you pay $150 of what you got, I'll be able to release you.
And I'll cut you a deal, yes, sir.
I'll cut you a deal. And you paid him $150.
I've given him $150.
So they can let you go.
Yes, sir. I didn't want to go to jail. Yes, sir.
Because you had traffic tickets and warrants. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And they never arrested you for the traffic ticket?
No, sir. They were since 2000. I tried to turn myself in, and they didn't want to take me, so they picked me up.
And they told you that in a little while, I'm going to turn on a video recording, and I'm going to record your statement. And if you say anything different than what I want you to say, you're going to go to jail.
Yes, sir.
That's what he told you, Oscar.
Yes, sir.
He told the court that he was scared while he was there. Detective Sanchez told him he better not talk to the defense attorneys.
And about a week or two after you gave that recording, you knew you had done something wrong.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I did.
And it was bothering you because it was wrong what that detective made you do.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you finally reached out and we spoke, didn't we?
Yes, sir. I didn't know who to write to.
And when we spoke, I said, well, let me show you the video statement, Oscar, that I got from the state. And that's when I said, you saw the whole statement, correct?
Yes.
And that's the first time you saw a statement. You said, that's not all of it. And that's when I said, what do you mean? And you told me, let me tell you what happened before. And let me tell you what they told me that's not on the tape. And let me tell you how they threatened me. And let me tell you how they told me, if you don't say what you want, you're going to go to jail. And he told you, you better save your own ass. Is that what he told you?
Yes, sir.
After the state presented their case, the defense requested a directed verdict, but they were denied. The defense decided not to call any witnesses anyway, and the trial moved to closing arguments.
They're insulting. This courtroom has turned into
As Daniel
a
sat at the defense table, awaiting his fate, he was no doubt nervous and anxious. But at the same time, this wasn't a feeling that was new to him. This wasn't a situation that was new to him. In fact, he was almost used to this by now, although it had been a while. This wasn't the first time Daniel Villegas had been tried for this murder. It's Halloween this month, and you might be thinking, what's scarier than shopping for home and auto insurance? Although it may seem like a daunting task, Policy Genius makes it easy. They combine a cutting-edge insurance marketplace with help from licensed experts to save you time and money. Here's how it works. First, go to policygenius.com and answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then, sit back and relax because Policy Genius does the rest. They compare rates from over 30 top insurers from Progressive to Nationwide to find the absolute lowest quotes. Their licensed experts will look at all the ways to maximize your savings, including bundling your home and auto policies. If Policy Genius finds a better rate than what you're currently paying, they'll get you switched for free. It's no wonder that Policy Genius has earned a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. So if you're a homeowner, head on over to policygenius.com right now to get started. They've saved their home and auto insurance customers an average of $1,127 a year. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. If you're a business owner, you don't need me to tell you that running a business is tough, but you might be making it harder on yourself than necessary. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. It's time to upgrade to NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you the information you need when you need it. Ditch the spreadsheets and all the old software you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more, everything you need all in one place instantaneously. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, save time and money with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies using NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/court. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/court. That's netsuite.com/court. On December 5th, 1994, about a year and a half after the murders, Daniel Villegas was at the defense table for the first time. He was 17. At this trial, prosecutors had one major advantage, a confession from Daniel himself to Detective Alfonso Marquez. Daniel had made it known that he recanted that confession a few hours after giving it, even telling one of the juvenile probation officers that he had only confessed because the detectives were harassing him. But the confession was introduced when Detective Marquez took the stand. He denied that it was obtained through any threats, promises, or any other illegal interrogation tactics. The prosecution also called some of Daniel's friends to the stand, all of whom had implicated Daniel at some point, but all of whom said they had been coerced. Daniel's cousin, David Rangel, testified too about what Daniel had told him, but he maintained on cross that he believed Daniel had been joking. In fact, he said Daniel often talked shit and pretended to have committed crimes in which he actually had no involvement. The defense called several witnesses who corroborated Daniel's alibi that he and his friends had been babysitting and were watching the movie White Men Can't Jump at the time of the killings. They also called multiple witnesses who said that Daniel had a history of lying. A forensic psychiatrist testified that Daniel had dropped out of school in just seventh grade and that he had possible mild mental retardation. Daniel himself testified too and said Detective Marquez had forced him into confessing and that he was actually innocent. The defense then called multiple witnesses who stated that Detective Marquez has a reputation for untruthfulness, that he had actually gone before a grand jury twice for a possible perjury indictment, that he had been the subject of a number of internal affairs investigations, and that there were roughly 30 citizen complaints against him. The trial ended with a hung jury, who were deadlocked at 11-1 in favor of guilty. Daniel was retried the following year, in August 1995. He had a new attorney who only called one witness for the defense, a sharpshooter expert who said it would be difficult to shoot two men the way Daniel said he shot them in his confession. But perhaps most notable was in Daniel's attorney's closing arguments, where he said Daniel had no intention of killing anyone and that he was just reckless. Daniel was found guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. He filed an appeal, but was denied in 1997. In 2011, however, Daniel's attorneys tried again. This time, they filed for a writ of habeas corpus and asked for a new trial due to ineffective assistance of counsel. But later, with the help of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern University School of Law, they amended the motion, this time to include the claim of actual innocence. Witnesses had recanted their statements, and new information was coming to light. Judge Sam Medrano Jr. examined the claims and held a hearing. In 2012, he concluded that Daniel did indeed deserve a new trial. In his ruling, he wrote that Daniel's attorney was ineffective, that he should have challenged the truthfulness of Daniel's confession, as well as the claims in his friend's statements, which were, in many places, contradictory to the actual evidence. For example, one of the statements was from Daniel's friend, Rodney Williams, who was 15. Rodney told Detective Scott Graves that he, Daniel, Fernando Lujan, Marcos Gonzalez, and Enrique Ramirez all went out that night. They were in a white car. He said they stole some beer from a convenience store, and as they were driving back, they saw four guys on Trans Mountain Road. They got into an argument, and Daniel pulled out his gun and started shooting. Rodney was charged with murder too, but charges were later dropped after prosecutors said they had insufficient evidence to charge him. Judge Medrano pointed out inconsistencies in Rodney's statement, that there was no evidence that any beer had ever been stolen from any store, that Enrique Ramirez and Fernando Luján couldn't have been involved. Enrique was in jail, and Fernando was wearing an electronic monitor at the time. There were problems with David Ronhell's statement, too. David had said Daniel told him that he was in a black car that night, but both Jesse and Juan, the two survivors of the shooting, had said the car they saw was red, maroon, or goldish, not black. David had said Daniel told him that he shot Armando once, saw him running to a nearby home, and then chased him to the house and shot him again. But no shell casings were ever recovered near Armando's body. And David had said Daniel told him that the boys had thrown up gang signs after he stopped his car, but Jesse's and Juan's statements disputed that. Judge Medrano wrote, quote, "Applicant Villegas received constitutionally deficient assistance that prejudiced his trial. Moreover, this court believes that the new evidence presented at the writ hearing adequately meets the standard to demonstrate Villegas's actual innocence." So what was that new evidence? Well, hang on to your seats, because it's quite a doozy. The following information for this part of the episode is directly from the findings of facts and conclusions of law put forth by Judge Sam Medrano Jr. On April 10, 1993, the evening after the shootings of Armando Lazo and Bobby England, there was another shooting near the scene. Present when officers arrived was Rudy Flores. A .22 caliber gun was recovered, but it was never compared to the .22 caliber casings found at the earlier shooting. And that same gun would eventually be destroyed by the El Paso Police Department 5 years later. After the shootings of Bobby England and Armando Lazo, four people contacted the El Paso PD to tell them that they believed Rudy and/or Javier Flores were the shooters. 2 days later, on April 12th, is when Jesse Hernandez was called back into the police station for another interview. Detective Marquez asked him to write down what happened on a piece of paper. While he was in the middle of writing, Detective Marquez took the paper, threw it at him, and told him to, quote, "just cut the bullshit." Detective Marquez then accused Jesse of having killed his friends and told him that Juan had already implicated him. If he didn't confess, Jesse would go to prison and get the death penalty. Jesse didn't confess, but he would later testify in the evidentiary hearing and at Daniel's last trial that he was close to it. On April 14th, Javier Flores gave a statement to police. He said he and his brother Rudy lived together and that he came home at about 12:30 a.m. on the night of the shooting and Rudy was not home. Later that day, Detective Marquez interviewed Rudy. Rudy told him that he drove past the house on Jamaica Street at around 11 p.m. that night. He said at around midnight, he was in a car going east on Trans Mountain Road and that he then went home. On April 15th, based on a tip, another boy was brought in for questioning, 15-year-old Michael Johnston. Without his parents present, Michael was interrogated by Detective Marquez and Detective Scott Graves from 7 p.m. until 3 a.m. During these 8 hours, Michael was handcuffed. Detective Marquez accused him of being the killer and told him that his friend had already said he did it. He told Michael that he would get the death penalty, specifically the electric chair, if he didn't confess, saying he would even pull the switch himself. He further threatened to take Michael to a jail where he would be molested and raped if he did not confess. If he did confess, however, he would get off easy. Michael did end up confessing, but he was never charged. Detective Marquez would later say that his confession was false. Throughout the investigation, there were other confessions too, at least from three other people, none of whom were ever charged. Shortly after 10 p.m. on April 21st, Detective Marquez and Detective Arbogast entered Daniel's home with an arrest warrant for Marcos Gonzalez. Marcos was 18 at the time. Daniel was 16. Marcos was placed under arrest, and after they learned who Daniel was, the detectives placed him under arrest too. During the ride to the police station, Daniel repeatedly told Detective Marquez that he was 16, a juvenile. Detective Marquez accused him of lying, but after arriving at the police station, Daniel's age was confirmed. Detective Marquez told him that he was a lucky punk, and Daniel was transported to Juvenile Investigative Services. Meanwhile, Marcos was questioned by Detective Scott Graves. According to Marcos's testimony at the hearing, Detective Graves threatened to beat him if he did not confess. He was told that he would be put in county jail where he would be screwed by fat old men. Detective Graves then told him that he was really only interested in going after Daniel for the killings. When Marcos refused to confess, he said Detective Graves slammed him against the wall repeatedly. He then signed a statement, essentially stating that he and some other friends, including Daniel, were riding around in a car when they came across the four boys. They yelled out to them, and the boys yelled back. They then went and retrieved a gun, and on their way back to the boys, Marcos said he got out of the car. He said later, Daniel told him that he had shot and killed Armando Lazo. Later that night, around 11 p.m., Detective Marquez took Daniel to Juvenile Investigative Services, where Daniel was put into an interrogation room and was handcuffed to a chair. At 11:15, Daniel signed his Miranda warning card. According to his testimony at the hearing, then the following happened. Daniel was questioned for about an hour while handcuffed to the chair. Detective Marquez told him that if he didn't confess, he would be put in county jail, where he would be, quote, raped and fucked. Detective Marquez also threatened to kick his ass and take him to the desert and beat him if he didn't confess. When Daniel kept insisting that he was innocent, Detective Marquez then slapped him. Daniel testified that he had never been interrogated before and was terrified out of his mind. Daniel was then supposed to go before Magistrate Carl Horkowitz, who was required to warn him of his rights prior to any interrogation. Detective Marquez told Daniel just before that, quote, "You are going to tell the judge that you are going to make a statement, and if you don't, you already know what I'm going to do to you, motherfucker. I am going to take you to the desert and beat your ass." As a result, Daniel said he did tell Magistrate Horkowitz that he would give a statement. He testified that he was mentally paralyzed by Detective Marquez's continual threats. Daniel then met with Detective Marquez again. He spoke while the detective typed. Daniel said his friend Rodney Williams had actually told him that he killed Armando and Bobby. According to Daniel, Detective Marquez then took the paper from the typewriter, crumpled it up, and slapped him. Detective Marquez then threatened Daniel that he would pull the switch on the electric chair himself if Daniel did not confess to being the shooter. He said Marcos Gonzalez had also implicated him as the shooter. Detective Marquez then prepared a one-page statement that said Daniel and his friends were together in a white vehicle on the night of the shooting, and that when they got into an argument with the boys, Daniel fired one shot in the air to scare them, followed by more shots. It said Armando was getting away, and so someone finished him off while he was running away. Daniel signed this confession at 2:40 a.m. Around the same time, Marcos Gonzalez was being re-interrogated by Detective Graves. His initial statement didn't match Daniel's. At the evidentiary hearing for Daniel's new trial, Detective Graves testified that he was in contact with Detective Marquez during this time period. Marcos ultimately signed a second statement, typed up by Detective Graves. This one was more in alignment with Daniel's. As soon as Daniel left Detective Marquez, he recanted his confession to Monica Sotelo, a juvenile probation officer. He said he didn't do it, that the police had harassed him and that he was, quote, tired and wanted to go back to sleep, so he only told them what they wanted to hear. At some point during the investigation, an exculpatory tape recording was made in which a witness divulged the identity of a killer who was not Daniel, as well as the location of the .22 caliber gun used in the murders. This tape went missing before trial and has never been found. And so Daniel was ordered a new trial. The state had appealed the decision, but it was upheld by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in December 2013. However, they disagreed with Judge Medrano that Daniel had met the standard for actual innocence. Daniel was released from prison in January 2014, and prosecutors made it known that they planned on retrying him. This time, though, they would have to do it without Daniel's confession. Judge Medrano ruled that it was inadmissible because it was obtained by, quote, coercive conduct by police officers. Daniel was offered a plea deal, an Elford plea, which meant that he could plead guilty without actually admitting guilt and wouldn't have to serve any more time. But Daniel refused. He wanted that third trial. In October 2018, after 8 hours of deliberation, the jury had reached their verdict. Daniel waited to hear his fate for the third time.
In the District Court of El Paso County, Texas, 409th Judicial District, the State of Texas versus Daniel Villegas, number 94-0D09328. Verdict Form B. We, the jury, find the defendant Daniel Villegas not guilty of...
The courtroom erupted into cheers, and Daniel collapsed on the defense table, held up only by his attorneys. He cried and sobbed. His nightmare was finally over.
Mr. Villegas, you have been under many conditions in this court. You are no longer under any conditions in this court. You are free to leave.
Thank you.
Good luck to you, sir.
After the trial, prosecutor James Montoya said the El Paso County District Attorney's Office still believes that Daniel is guilty. Quote, there are no other suspects. There is no one else to investigate. We believe when the defendant confessed to his cousin, to his friend, that those were truthful confessions and that he was admitting his guilt. He made no mention of Daniel's confession to police. Just last week, Jamie Esparza, the district attorney, said he will not be seeking re-election next year, that this year will be his last. He reiterated his belief that in this case, they got the right guy, and said this case will eat at him. Daniel has since filed a civil lawsuit against the city of El Paso and several police officers, including Detectives Marquez and Graves, for violating his civil rights. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you believe the last jury got it right? What do you make of the reported behavior of the detectives in this case? Let me know by joining the discussion on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. To hear these episodes ad-free and to check out additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, go to CourtJunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. And don't forget to subscribe to my new YouTube channel, where I'll be posting some behind-the-scenes videos and some other fun stuff. That's at youtube.com/CourtJunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
I grew up in arguably the wealthiest town in the United States, Darien, Connecticut. But my mom and I were on food stamps and welfare. My first punk rock show was to an audience of one dog, and my first electronic music show was to Miles Davis.
I wanted to stop the show and patiently explain to the movie stars and the beautiful people that they'd made a mistake.
They were celebrating me, but I was a nothing. I was a kid from Connecticut who wore secondhand clothes in the front seat of his mom's car while she cried and tried to figure out where she could borrow money to buy groceries. Now it was 1999. I was an insecure has-been. But we kept playing, and the celebrities kept dancing and cheering.
The weird thing is, things started to go wrong when I stopped feeling that way. 1999, I thought that my career had ended.
Yeah.
My mom had died of cancer. I was battling substance abuse problems. I was battling panic attacks. I'd lost my record deal, and I was making this one last album. And I was like, okay, I'll make this album. I'll put it out. I'll move back to Connecticut. I'll get a job teaching philosophy at some community college. And then all of a sudden, the world embraced me. I handled fame and wealth really disastrously. It was so humiliating. I wouldn't trade any of it.
For more from Moby, including how he bounced back from a 400 drink per month booze habit, check out episode 196 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.